This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow. As Congress debates energy policy, there is no shortage of alternative energy ideas, some that get lots of attention. You know them, solar, wind, stuff like that. Others you don't hear much about. They get lost in the journals or they're confined to the backwaters of the internet. Well, this hour we're going to talk about new thinking in one conventional alternative energy, wind power, and new ideas in really alternative energies like this first one. My first guest has come up with a new approach to storing hydrogen to power fuel cells, for example. Here's the recipe. You take billions of chicken feathers, you remove the quills, and then you cook the feathers, but don't cook them so much that you burn them. And what does that do? Well, after they're cooked, the heating makes little nooks and crannies in the feathers that are perfect for storing hydrogen. The cost is low, of course, because the feathers are a byproduct of the chicken industry. You get them for next to nothing. Here to tell us more about the promise of feathers and fuel cells is Richard Wool. He's professor of chemical engineering at the University of Delaware. He and his colleagues presented this research at the Green Chemistry and Engineering Conference this week. He joins us from his office in Newark. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ira. Pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. Did I describe that recipe correctly?
That was a very good introduction. We do indeed take the chicken feather fiber, and we heat it up, and we make all these nanopores that hydrogen likes to adsorb on. And so this is potentially a very cheap substrate for future generation cars, car tanks that will be used in the automotive industry.
How do you get the hydrogen into the feathers?
You put it in under pressure and preferably at reduced temperatures.
And it just soaks it up into those pores?
It soaks it up. It's a well-known fact that carbonaceous substrates and other chemical substrates like metal hydrides like to fizz-adsorb hydrogen. And so the trick is to get very, very high surface area. The problem with hydrogen, because it's a gas, it likes to occupy a lot of space.
Right.
And it's a very, very light gas, so it has a very low energy density. And the whole trick here is to basically turn hydrogen gas into a two-dimensional solid by basically trying to absorb it as a carpet on the internal surface area of your substrate. And that's what people do with carbon. That's what they do with metal hydrides. And that's what we do with the chicken feather fiber, which is a keratin fiber. And there is also an optimal pore size of the order of 8 angstroms. These are like little tunnels that the hydrogen likes to be in. It's a form of potential energy entrapment of the hydrogen in these tunnels.
So you're making almost a perfect vessel for holding hydrogen out of the chicken feathers.
Yes, and you know the microstructure of these bird feathers really facilitates the development of these perfect tunnels.
And how does this approach compare, let's say, to other proposed hydrogen storage devices?
Other very good hydrogen storage devices out there, but the problem is that the majority of them are very, very expensive. And, you know, people have examined, for example, carbon nanotubes, multi-wall carbon nanotubes. They have looked at metal hydrides, different chemical hydride systems. There is a beautiful DOE program that is currently ongoing doing this. But if you look at the reality of the price of your gas tank on the ground, it is a bit mind-numbing to see the price of a gas tank made of carbon nanotubes. And so the one thing that we have going with us for the chicken feathers is that it is very, very cheap, but it also addresses a disposal problem for these chicken feathers in the first place. There are 6 billion pounds of them being generated by the poultry industry in America and more abroad. And so what to do with these? And this was part of our Green Engineered Materials program at the University of Delaware, where we are building new green materials for the renewable energy infrastructure. And this is a highly energy-intensive system. I know your next speaker is going to talk about wind, but you know the wind blades and the rest are going to require an enormous amount of materials. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got going with the chicken feathers, to see if we can make high-performance materials, just like we make now printed circuit boards for the electronic materials industry out of chicken feathers and soybeans. The windmill blades in the future will also be made out of soybeans and carbonized chicken feathers, where we use them for carbon fiber. Then came along the question, what about the hydrogen infrastructure? If these are so cheap, can we get the kinds of surface areas that we want at very reasonable cost that can store adequate amounts of hydrogen? And we're heading strongly in that direction.
Wow. All from all the stuff you can make out of chicken feathers.
It's an amazing piece of material, and it has evolved over millions of years. And of course, the birds have a rather unique evolutionary pathway. They can't afford to have a bad hair day, I suppose. And the materials that they develop that have evolved for them over the years are really quite extraordinary. And so we use them in hydrogen storage and in other very high-performance composite applications.
So you're saying instead of using carbon nanotubes, you can carbonize the chicken feathers and make the same kinds of products out of them?
Yeah, our chicken feathers have approximately the same type of hydrogen adsorption as the carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes would be expected to be a little better, particularly pure single-wall carbon nanotubes. And these are amazing materials, but extraordinarily expensive. We use them quite a bit in my own research group. So, getting the chicken feathers with pyrolyzed to generate these little nanopores is really the key for us, and getting high internal surface area. These fibers... most of your listeners will know this as down, either down, the hair from a duck. Well, this is chicken down. And these are basically hollow cylinders. And so in the future, we'll be able to fill the hollow cylinders with additional materials that we'll be absorbing, along with the type of fractal porous walls that we build into the walls of these microcrystalline keratin fibers.
How do you get the hydrogen out of the chicken feathers in your hydrogen tank?
One important way, it goes in under pressure. Typically, we use pressures of the order of 40 or 50 bars. And you might say, well, what does that correspond to? Well, Daimler Chrysler is using compressed hydrogen tanks with 700 bars in there at the moment. So that's a very, very low pressure compared to what one can actually do with a gas. Mm-hmm. And so you put it in under what I call low to moderate pressures, and then the hydrogen goes into the pores and it absorbs, and then you can just depressurize it the same way you'd let the air out of a balloon. And that would deliver it to your fuel cell, and then you can recharge it again when it goes down.
Mm-hmm. How close to any kind of practical device are you now? Can you actually demonstrate it? Are people interested in this, or are they just laughing at you, chicken feather?
No, people are interested in it, but there is quite a bit of research going on through NREL at DOE, looking at several other technologies that are currently being examined by the automotive industry and others. So at the moment, I would say that the development of the fuel cell is one line of approach, and people are saying, show us your cheapest and best storage device that comes along. And then the storage people are also pursuing this. So there are various levels of integration with the different technologies along the way. But the key issue at this point is to get the long-lasting fuel cells developed, and then different hydrogen feed systems will come along, either compressed gas, which is what Daimler Chrysler is doing, and GM is looking at that, or there will be a metal hydride case, as already exists to a certain extent. And then, maybe someone will say, let's explore the chicken feather tank.
How big a tank would it have to be? Or would it be, would you have to replace the chicken feathers at a fueling station, or you refill them with hydrogen?
You would refill it at a hydrogen station once the hydrogen infrastructure is set up. And so you're talking about, if the DOE standards of 6% by weight and appropriate volumes are met, then you're talking about something close to your normal 20-gallon tank. On the other hand, if we're at about a third of that or a fourth of that, then you're talking about something closer to, you know, 60 to 80 gallon tanks, which would not be an unreasonable thing to scale up at very, very low cost. The hydrogen would go in and it would be stored.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that you can use chicken feathers, this technology, for other materials too?
Yes. We have a significant program in our evolving GEM Center. It's a multinational, multi-university proposed center at Delaware to develop the green materials for the renewable energy infrastructure. For example, a windmill blade, a turbine blade about 60 meters long, you can make that out of soybeans and natural fibers and these chicken feathers. Our electronic materials that are going to go into your future Dells can be made of soybean oil and these fibers for reinforcement. So this has been an ongoing program with companies whose names you would well recognize. So that is to clean up the carbon footprint of the electronic materials industry. So that's a very, very nice application. Mm-hmm. But composites in general, supposing you wanted your car body made out of this, supposing you wanted that sleek sports car made out of green materials, then this is one way to do it.
Mm-hmm. All those billions of pounds of chicken feathers.
It's quite a supply, and they are basically for free at this point.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be on your show.
You're welcome. Richard Wall, who joined us from his office in Newark, Delaware, he and his colleagues presented his research at the Green Chemistry and Engineering Conference and interesting work at chemical engineering at the University of Delaware. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk more about alternative energy. We're going to talk about a new study of the potential of wind power. This study, published by the National Academy of Sciences, I wrote in my blog, it blew me away, but it certainly did, about how much the potential there is for wind power as an alternative energy. We'll talk about the amazing amount of wind there is around the world that could solve a lot of energy problems if we can actually boot it up. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR News.
As the week winds down, we're joined for our Friday political chat with our regular commentators, columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and David Brooks of The New York Times. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you.
And before we turn to things political, why don't we just pay a bit of attention here to Michael Jackson. And David Brooks, I'm curious if you have something in your personal memory bank that connects you with a Michael Jackson song.
I found myself actually surprisingly moved by his death. He was like, for those of us, I'm roughly his age, it's like every pop culture trend of our lives, he personified them. And I guess the theme of the week is the loneliness of people in public life. And you can get the adoration of the crowd that doesn't satisfy your needs. I went to a concert once of his, and it was different from most concerts in that most concerts, at least the really good ones, the artist converses with the audience. This was more or less a performance above the audience that we all admired. And so I think that emotional lack was obviously there throughout his life.
EJ, what about you?
Well, I wish he had taught me how to dance, and alas, he never did. He was a troubled man, but he was really gifted. I liked his songs very much. And I guess proving that you can politicize anything you want to, I have particularly loved the song Don't Stop Till You Get Enough, which I think I've thought of actually for a while as a perfect ballad for those active in politics, and maybe now we can make it the anthem for healthcare reform.
You need a little more rhythm in that, EJ, but work on that. Let's move on to broader world concerns, and let's start with Iran, and specifically the U.S. position on the disputed election there. We heard Iranian President Ahmadinejad this week saying that President Obama is using the same rhetoric as President Bush, and he called on President Obama to show repentance or apologize. President Obama was asked about that at a news conference today at the White House. Let's listen.
I don't take Mr. Ahmadinejad's statements seriously about apologies, particularly given the fact that the United States has gone out of its way not to interfere with the election process in Iran.
Okay, David, leaving aside this question of apology, is President Obama in the same situation as we talked about, say, a week ago on this program, in terms of how he is confronting Iran, what words he's using, the language he's choosing to talk about the government and the repression there?
Well, he's moved. He's moved quite a lot in the week and a half. And we've learned about President Obama that when there's a highly emotional situation, I think his first instinct is to pull back from that emotion and proceed cautiously. But he got, after a week or two, to the sort of tough rhetoric that I think he should have had a few days earlier. But the more important thing is where we go from here. And the question for the administration now is we know we have an Iranian regime which is not going to compromise. We also know they're much more reckless and clumsy than maybe we might have thought. So the lesson is we can't go back to the old engagement policy we envisioned. So where do we go from here? And that's really the big question.
Well, EJ, President Obama had made it a point during the campaign that he would be open to direct talks with Iran. Do you think he has to completely rethink that position now?
Well, I think the administration is rethinking its position, but it's not necessarily coming to the conclusion David has. It is possible that the regime will harden and that no talks are going to be possible. There's at least one chance in three that their regime is so discredited that they might actually choose engagement, maybe put something on the table in order to restore their standing in the world. And I think that might be difficult for the administration to walk away from. But I think Ahmadinejad's comments today really were evidence for why Obama was right to be cautious in the first place. He held off on strong words until the regime really showed its hands. Repression got very severe. And then he said what I think most Americans feel in attacking that regime.
We were talking about apologies, and there has been contrition aplenty coming from another corner. We're moving back to this country now, and we're talking about South Carolina, of course, and Governor Mark Sanford. Let's listen to what he had to say when he met with his cabinet today.
I've made general apologies to the people of South Carolina, to staff at large, but you all are really the epicenter of that team that, you know, through about 65,000 state employees, serves the people of South Carolina.
And Governor Sanford went on to single out several members of the cabinet, apologize personally to each. This, of course, after he went incommunicado from his office. His staff said he was hiking on the Appalachian Trail. It turned out he was, in fact, visiting his lover in Argentina, and he's been apologizing right and left. David Brooks, hard to know where even to begin on this subject, but what do you make of what's going on with Governor Sanford and what it means for the Republican Party?
Well, I have a high tolerance for people in public life who commit affairs because I think they're morally uncomfortable or wrong in private life, but I think people do compartmentalize and they can perform a public role. And so my tendency is always to want to forgive. But then you draw another distinction, and that's between the people who commit illicit, sleazy affairs where they don't actually care about the person and the people who actually fall in love. And in one way, the people who fall in love are less totally immoral than the sleazy ones, yet they do more damage to themselves, more damage, I think, to their families, and more damage to their ability to perform publicly because they've totally unmoored themselves. And I think Governor Sanford is clearly unmoored now and should at least take time off, if not resign totally, because he's clearly showed, as the press conference showed, a person who's not quite in control of his life.
It was a remarkable press conference. E.J. Diana went on and on and more soul-bearing, I think, than we've seen from just about any politician.
In some sense, more soul-bearing than you sometimes get from your best friend. I mean, it was really remarkable. I broadly sympathize with the theologian David Brooks and how he analyzed this. Although, you know, you look at Senator Ensign and Governor Sanford. Senator Ensign from Nevada, who had his own problem earlier. And I agree with David that this affair seemed much more serious and that the problems Senator Ensign has are more serious because they seem to be linked to money and other things. But the Republican Party's latest new idea is open marriage. I mean, I hate sex scandals, even though I follow them intently. And I wish we could collectively back away from them, but that would probably require politicians to be more reluctant to trot out their perfect families, and also they'd have to stop publicly judging the rest of us.
But is this more than a sex scandal? I mean, the Governor Sanford is now saying he will repay some of the public funds that were used for one of these trips during which he visited his lover. I mean, this is beyond just, is he hurting his wife and his family, isn't it, Dave?
Right. Well, that's why I think that the profundity of the affair, judging by the emails, it's like an addiction. He lost all mooring. And so one can't totally trust that he's making any decisions right at this point. It also affects the Republican race in 2012. And it's really reduced by a large percentage the share of people who are really plausible front-running candidates. Not that it was ever going to be great shakes, but now we're left, let's put it that way, with Mitt Romney and a few others. And that's actually not good for the Republican Party.
Do you think he'll resign, EJ? Do you think Governor Sanford will step down?
He seems to be trying to resist it. I agree with you. It does go beyond the sex. It's not only whether public money was used. Disappearing on your state, not even telling your staff where you are, that's troublesome sort of behavior.
EJ Dion of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution and David Brooks of the New York Times. Good to talk to you. Have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Now the time in the show when we make you hungry. This summer, Morning Edition is taking a tour of the nation's farmers markets and seeing the array of fruits and vegetables that could end up on our plates. NPR's Jennifer Ludden went to a farmers market here in Washington, D.C. for this look at an old-fashioned favorite, rhubarb.
Rhubarb looks something like celery, but its big, firm stalks can be green or red. Jim Crawford of New Morning Farm has been growing this vegetable in Pennsylvania for nearly four decades, and long ago he even started buying it from his neighbors. He noticed this tart-tasting perennial was languishing in their gardens, unharvested.
It sounds funny, but it was kind of common that people seem to have that attitude about rhubarb.
Dismissive.
Yeah, dismissive, right. And then, of course, when they got $1.60 a pound for it, they said, hey, you know, this stuff is worth something.
In recent years, Crawford's seen a resurgence in demand for rhubarb, often fueled by nostalgia, as with customer Ed Kale. He says he doesn't actually buy it a lot.
But I grew up with rhubarb, and it reminds me of my grandmother and my mother, and they made these luscious pies. I'll probably just buy it and let it rot in my refrigerator. But I have aspirations, either to make a pie or nothing else. They make this killer rhubarb jello bowl.
Kale admits that sounds kind of gross, but he swears rhubarb in fruit-flavored jello makes a great buffet dish.
Okay.
Over at the cash registers, Janet Katz says rhubarb makes her nervous.
I don't know, I'm afraid. I've cooked everything but rhubarb, but I've never tried rhubarb. I'm afraid it'll be too sour or chewy or something.
Yeah. Crawford finds this a lot, so he posts a helpful hint sign.
It's the easiest thing in the world to cook. It takes about 5 minutes. You just chop it up and put some sweetener with it and put it in a pan with a tight lid, and in about 5 minutes it just melts like butter.
Crawford sweetens his with maple syrup, but sugar works too. He likes rhubarb sauce over ice cream. He also puts rhubarb in jam, chutney, and a whole array of pies, not just the classic strawberry rhubarb combo.
In fact, I really like it better with apples. It's really good with raspberries. It's really good with peaches.
Whatever's in season, Jim Crawford says rhubarb gives it pizzazz. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm looking at a recipe right now for rhubarb pie on our website, npr.org. Seriously, it only takes a few ingredients to make this, so you should really check it out.
Yum, yum.
Some senators said yesterday they are edging ever closer to a deal to overhaul the country's health care system. Their goal is a plan that would provide insurance coverage to nearly all Americans with a price tag under $1 trillion. Oh, and by the way, none of that cost could add to the federal deficit. This all means much of the money will have to come from healthcare industry groups, insurers, doctors, hospitals, and others. But those groups are going to want change that will help them in return. Chip Kahn is president of the Federation of American Hospitals, which represents about 1,000 for-profit hospitals and health facilities. And I asked him what hospitals are actually looking for in a revamped healthcare system.
Our main issue is today people don't come to the hospital with a level playing field. We really want all Americans to have the security of coverage and not have the pressure of worrying about the financial aspect of it.
You said level playing field. What exactly is that, and when is the playing field not level?
Well, I think we have an unlevel playing field now with almost 50 million Americans who don't have coverage. It affects them in many ways. First, when they need care, they may be reticent to come because of the cost. And second, it means that they're less likely to be receiving ongoing care if they have a chronic illness or other kind of condition that might prevent them from having to go to the hospital in the first place.
We have Democrats in Congress right now. We have the Obama White House, and they pretty strongly support the creation of some kind of government-sponsored health plan that would compete with private insurance companies. And the aim would be to keep insurance costs low. How would a public plan like that affect hospitals? And do you see it as good or bad?
I don't think health reform is about the public option. It is one of the aspects of health reform. And the public option, frankly, if it was as large as it could be, would be detrimental to hospitals and physicians and providers generally and the patients they serve.
But are you open to some kind of public option?
We're open to any kind of reform that makes the insurance market work better on the one hand. On the other hand, Medicaid and Medicare, the two public programs now, don't pay hospitals sufficiently for the services they provide. To simply push more of it back on the public side is not going to solve some of the financing problems we have.
Well, those Medicare, Medicaid funds that hospitals get and rely on, that is something I wanted to ask you about. Because one idea that's been floated is that we have these disproportionate share payments to hospitals. They get more money through Medicare, Medicaid funds if they have patients who are not insured. It can be a lot of money in the case of some hospitals. The idea would be that if the goal is to insure everyone, hospitals don't need that much money. That would be one way for hospitals to say, this is a savings that we're willing to offer. Has that been talked about? Is that something you're open to?
Well, I think it's premature because you've got to see the whole proposal. And clearly, whatever is done in this legislation is probably not going to affect the undocumented aliens. Many of those ultimately seek care if they need it at hospitals in the emergency rooms. So I think the disproportionate share payments are likely to be needed in perpetuity, even if health reform is successful. But clearly, it'll be a discussion item.
A discussion item meaning if the Democrats came and said, look, if we can agree that once everyone is covered or once we have almost everyone covered, hospitals will give up some of these disproportionate share funds.
You know, my grandfather taught me a number of things, always buy wholesale, and second, never negotiate with yourself. So I'm reticent to discuss it here, but clearly it'll be an issue on the table.
Chip Khan, you represent about 1,000 hospitals. Where is the sacrifice that hospitals would be willing to make?
Well, I think that there are going to be legislators in Congress who are going to ask hospitals through their payments to help contribute. If there's a contribution, there's got to be some
kind assurance. Of contribution what kind of contribution are we talking about?
Well, obviously, hospitals receive a lot of public payment that's considered on the public ledger by the Congressional Budget Office, and that's what's going to be discussed.
Medicare, Medicaid funds, those types of?
Medicare funds are going to be discussed, yes. We've got to have more coverage, but hopefully most of that coverage will end up being private coverage, which will pay us sufficiently to offer the kind of services that the communities expect.
Chip, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
My pleasure.
Chip Khan is president of the Federation of American Hospitals. He represents about 1,000 for-profit hospitals and health facilities in the U.S.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. Several years ago, the journalist Mark Bohl was embedded with a bomb squad while covering American troops in Iraq. That experience led him to write the screenplay for the new war movie, The Hurt Locker. It follows a bomb squad on its daily rounds. Our critic Bob Mondello says it follows a little closer than some moviegoers might find comfortable.
There's nothing quite like blowing up a major star in the first 5 minutes of a movie to put an audience on notice. I won't tell you who. Suffice it to say, he seems to be being cautious, first using a radio-controlled robot to explode a bomb half a block away, and then when the robot gets stuck, donning a bulky protective suit and helmet that make him look like a deep-sea diver.
Nice and hot in here.
All as it happens for naught.
Okay, I'm laying on the charge. Nice and sweet. I'm coming back.
His men warily watch the locals, looking for triggering devices. And when he's still much too close, they spot one.
25.
25 meters, roger that.
Butcher shop, 2 o'clock, dude has a phone.
Why is Eldridge running? Come on, guys, talk to me.
Drop the phone!
Hey, boom!
I can't get a shot!
This is a guy who's careful So when the guy replacing him appears more cavalier, it really spooks the squad. And after this opening should spook audiences as well. Staff Sergeant Will James, played by Jeremy Renner, may be a careful, even a talented technician, but he comes off as a showboating cowboy, as likely as not to strip off his protective gear when he approaches a bomb.
What's he doing?
I don't know.
What are you doing? There's enough bagging there to send us all to Jesus. If I'm gonna die, I wanna die comfortable.
The adrenaline rush of war has been largely missing from Hollywood's Iraq, but it's certainly front and center in The Hurt Locker, the first war movie in a while that feels as if it could have starred John Wayne. Director Kathryn Bigelow ratchets up tension and jangles nerves with scene after scene that could go either way, as when the squad tries to free a terrified Iraqi who's been chained into a bomb harness.
There's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it.
I do.
I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let go of me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Get down now.
If the film were just a series of explosions artfully shot, Bigelow might lay claim to making a ferociously effective war flick, but she and screenwriter Mark Bowl are aiming a little higher. They want to get inside the heads of the men in the squad, a trickier proposition. When the film gets misty about subsidiary characters, it also gets a bit lost, but more often it's psychologically astute, especially when demonstrating how friction between the new guy and the squad smooths a bit when they discover he's got a sentimental side, a keepsake box filled with bomb parts.
This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
There are things the Hurt Locker does not do. The Iraqis mostly are just scowling faces, and the reasons for the American presence are left to other movies. The focus here is on a single bomb squad, and if the quote that first lights up the screen, "War is a drug," has been amply illustrated by the end of The Hurt Locker, what Bigelow makes even more explosively clear is that for these men, war is also centrally a job they have to be really good at, or they won't do it for long. I'm Bob Mondello.
You can watch clips from The Hurt Locker and find reviews of lighter fare, including the new Transformers movie, at npr.org.